On RSN 927's Racing Pulse, welcome to The Verdict.
Bruce McAvaney blew me away on Saturday morning when he said that he believes that Winx is the best horse that has ever raced in Australia, and he has her as number one.
I agree.
Can't remember who tweeted this on my timeline today, but they pointed out US Navy flag, worst tour of Australia since England in the 2006-07 Ashes.
I wanted to have to claw her way to do it.
Do you think there would be a better chance of the Autumn Sun running the Cox Plate if he was trained by a different trainer?
Oh, there'd probably be more serious thought of it for sure. He could start this Saturday and not beat her the following Saturday in the Cox Plate.
Lloyd's quote was about, you got four runners and what's your threat? And he said, taking on Darren Weir these days is like taking on the West Coast Eagles and they've got 22 on the field instead of 18.
Welcome to The Verdict. It is great to have the boys together for the first time in 2019 because Mickey Lynch is back, the head honcho at the Age Sport Department, who's been on holiday and leave, probably overseas as well.
No, but
you're back looking fit and raring to go.
Yeah, not overseas, no, but lazing around on a beach doing my great Moby Mick impression, you know, the great one.
You don't frequent the same types of beaches at Matty Stewart.
No, I don't go to
Although we did meet at that beach last year for a bit of Ashes cricket,
Yeah, Matt and I met at the beach in South Australia where we did play Ashes cricket and his son embarrassed me terribly. I'm a shocking batsman.
You know what he does? It's like a scene out of Bride's Head Revisited. He sits under the jetty in the shade reading a book.
I do.
With his hat on.
With my hat on and occasionally a laptop where I just, you know, tap out pearls of wisdom for columns and such like. It's a great way to live and work, I've got to say.
what was that, the old Wimbles of Wimbledon or whatever it was.
Oh, the Wobbles of Wimbledon. Yeah, it's not like
the little mole under the...
No. You have to get... When you've got this kind of whey-faced intellectual complexion like I have, you know, the ghost, you've got to get plenty of cover in the Australian sun. But I love the hot. I can't, you know... Having grown up in a country where it was dark for 4 months of the winter, you go to school in the dark, you come home in the dark. I don't complain.
Well, I'll tell you where it was hot. And that was up at the Gold Coast on Saturday, Magic Millions Day. And you know, we'd been talking pre-race saying that maybe it's an even bunch, not that good. But I think the winner and maybe even the first three are well and truly above average. And we could be talking in 12 months to say that was a pretty good addition because I loved the run of Dubious. But Exhilarates had nothing go right. And there are no excuses for anything behind her.
Well, it's just typical of two-year-old racing, isn't it, where they can launch themselves on the day, can't they? Like James was saying on Saturday morning, he said, well, no one had heard of my two-year-old a month ago, say 6 weeks ago. Then it runs the blinding second at Wyong, and then it does this, and then it goes bang, and it's the preparation's all gone perfectly. And sometimes, you know, it's you may not get them back again. They may just peak on one day and put in that massive performance, and then... You know, who knows if the resurrection will happen for the Golden Slipper.
It's not as if Sheikh Mohammed needs the money, but she doesn't really need to peak on any other day again, does she, after picking up, what is it, a couple of million, the prize money for that race?
Yeah.
I watched the race again just now before we came in. It couldn't have gone worse for her, really, could it? I mean, and the second horse had the dream run on the fence. Everything went right for him, yet she's still able to come slingshotting around the outside and get there. Quite an extraordinary run.
But there's so many factors, especially with two-year-olds. Like Unite and Conquer had been the one all the way along. They plotted the course and they won in Melbourne and then on the way through and all that. And then there was a murmurings that the long-time favourite had just been a bit off its game on the day, leading into the day, and it got out in the market, drew the car park, and then game over. It's amazing how quickly it can be all over, isn't it?
Well, absolutely. Well, I think the two things that come out of the victory are James Cummings' training feats and what he's been achieving with Godolphin since he's taken over as the head trainer. Just remarkable statistics, the way all the horses are running. And Kieran McAvoy, it's almost, we were thinking, I was trying to think over the weekend about a jockey who's had a run like it. And it was the Scott Seamer era that you mentioned 10, 15 years ago where he was winning everything. Every major race or...
For the richest races.
Yeah, three of the biggest races on the calendar within 2 to 3 month period, the Everest, the Melbourne Cup and the Magic Millions. And from all distance ranges, Kieran McAvoy has just outridden every other jockey because they've been different types of rides, and the coolness, the calmness, not everything going right, is just phenomenal on the big day when it counts.
It is amazing. And when you do you remember when he first came back?
Yeah, I was about to mention that.
Wildly potted by all and sundry in Sydney, wasn't he?
Yep.
You know, he doesn't get the tempo. He doesn't get how races here are run. But whether that was true or not, I wasn't up there in Sydney, but it was quite extraordinary to see a bloke with his track record. I mean, you do not work in Europe for Godolphin for the best part of 8 years as Frankie's number two without being very, very good, you know.
Well, I remember that. It may be nearly 10 years now where that all
probably
happened. So
was,
he came back from Europe. The Sydney media were all over him. Like not riding to their speed maps and flashing home and missing
the boat.
The
stewards were all over him.
Ray Murray, he charged him off the back of a big reaction to a race where the only claim was that he missed the boat and should have got going earlier. And McAvoy said, well, who says I should have got going earlier? I know what I'm doing, you know. So he gave him a month, and then it was – and back in those days, the appeals board was a rubber stamp for the stewards. Like whatever the stewards did, the appeals board never disagreed with. But that was the first time in ages that they sided with the jockey. And I reckon that sort of cleared the way a bit. From that moment on, everything sort of seemed to go well for him.
Well, I think that experience he had overseas clearly instrumental in making him the player he is, the rider he is. I mean, because you ride in England, France, Ireland, all over the place when you're with Godolphin. The tracks are right-hand, left-hand, figures of eight, up and down. You're riding stayers, sprinters, basically semi-jumpers half the time. You know, it can't help but make you much, much better. And he's showing just what a career... And he's at the height of his career, isn't he? What is he, mid to late 30s?
Yeah.
Now,
oh, he's got a long...
He's got a long
but you know
way
what happened after that thing 10 years ago? Racing adapted McAvoy's way. McAvoy didn't adapt to the crazy mad rush, go forward and take off. And what happened was they started running their races a bit more sensibly, and the trainers like Waller who emerged along was a bit against the Waterhouse style and all that. But the trainers who started coming along in the last decade have actually... The way Kieran McAvoy has always ridden has actually better suited them than the way that the steward and the media wanted him to ride 10 years ago.
I think you're right. There has been a change, possibly because of so many European horses that are now in training in this country. And the breed has, you know, been changing for 20 years, hasn't it? And maybe that's being reflected in the kind of stock that's coming through and the tempo and the way they... are best used in a race.
But the thing that helped him in the Magic Millions, I was having a chat to Tony Golan a couple of weeks ago, and what's something that you've always noticed about Queensland racing? They go like scalded cats in every race, don't they? They just, whatever it is. And I asked Tony Golan about it. I said, why do they go like scalded cats up there? And he said, I don't know. We just always have. You know, it's here in Perth. He said, Melbourne and Sydney is different. He said, but here, even over distance, he said, for some reason... Whether it was because Doomben was always, and the Gold Coast predominantly tight
tracks. Yeah, and often firmish ground, I suppose.
He said, we just do. He said, we just go like scalded cats. And every time you talk to a Victorian jockey who goes up there, they go, oh, geez, I wasn't ready for that, you know. So, but that the winner of the Magic Millions kind of benefited from the scalded cat.
Well, and it was always going to be the case when the favourites who are up on speed types from the Waterhouse stable had drawn so wide. Can she... Last one on McAvoy before I ask you about how good you think she is. Is he the best jockey currently in Australia? I mean, it ebbs and flows with the, you know, your Bowmans, your Ollies and that. But big race jockey, if you were going to have one to ride a horse for your life, who would it be?
Noel Callow. He would get the job done. But he's not glamorous, is he, Litchie?
Callow isn't, no.
No, I mean, Kieran, for all his glamorous wins in glamorous races, he's still not a glamour
jockey.
But
he's a kind of down-home sort of guy, isn't he? He's not
ostentatious. He's got a beautiful wife and family. Yeah, he's softly, politely spoken.
He's not flashy. He's not out there, you know. Remember Glenn Boss used to put on masks and pump the crowd up? You never see Kieran McAvoy do that. The great thing for him, too, is he can ride so light.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he can, you know, virtually ride anything. 24-horse field, Melbourne Cup, Cox Plate three-year-olds. He can get down and do that. I think that is such a big advantage for him.
But isn't perception the thing, though? Like, Hugh Bowman is a fantastic jockey, but he's got that Winx status, hasn't he? Like, and all the images of him coming back, doing the winks gesture, coming back. So, but if you were to compare Bowman and McAvoy, I reckon you could, you know, there's no way in the world that Bowman's a better jockey than McAvoy, and probably no way that McAvoy's a better jockey than Bowman, but the one who turns heads walking down the street is Hugh Bowman.
That's the winks factor, isn't it?
Yeah. But Ollie comes into the equation. It's all about perception.
McAvoy's won three Melbourne Cups.
Yeah.
Yeah, so. And he's still in his mid-30s. There's every chance he could. He's four, isn't it, is the record.
But what I'm saying is, for all that, he still maintains his invisibility, doesn't he? He's still not...
Yeah, but he probably likes it that way. No, most high-profile sportsmen. I mean, you talk to... I know you're interviewing Craig Bellamy at the weekend, Michael. You talk to the rugby league players from the Storm, and they love the fact they can walk around Billy Slater and Cam Smith. No one bothers them. They go for a coffee in Richmond, and they're left alone, you know. And I think Kieran McAvoy would probably quite like that.
So out of the two-year-olds race, in 12 months' time, who are we going to be saying is the best horse out of the millions?
Probably the winner.
How would you know? I mean, there's so much that's going to depend on...
Is she a genuine golden slipper chance now, do you think?
I'll tell you what, she must be one of the toughest two-year-olds Godolphin have had. I mean, she's had, was it five starts now, and it's first week of January. It's a kind of right old-fashioned sort of prep, isn't it? Didn't they, before, in the 30 years ago, didn't they used to have 7, 8, 9, 10 runs as two-year-olds?
Yeah, since the
10th of November. Yeah, well, since the 10th of November, that's her fifth start. Well, so there's a query on whether she'll actually get there. As Vin Cox said earlier, he said, that's the aim, but she'll tell us whether she's had enough. But he said she's improved four lengths every start. So if she's, you know, continually on that upward spiral, they still think Tassort is head and shoulders their best two-year-old that they've got.
Yeah, I heard that interview with you were doing with him, and when's he out next?
He has to run the next fortnight.
Silver Slipper, 3 weeks. I think, is the traditional route.
It certainly sounded as if Vin Cox thinks he is their number one seed, doesn't it?
What about Dubious? Beautiful ride, Michael Walker, as you said before, Lynchy. No excuses. He's a very good colt, and there is some talk that Hightail is another one who's just come out of nowhere. That was his third run in a row, and gee, he was backed on the day. Might be sold over to Asia, so there's some thought that that might be the situation there. But outside of the top three, there's nothing that you could really get excited about.
They actually went quite a long way clear, didn't they, of the chasing pack?
But it's kind of irrelevant. You know what it's about? It's about the grab for cash. It's about the immature two-year-old. Even Godolphin isn't thinking beyond the golden slipper. They don't, like Tassalt, life beyond the golden slipper doesn't matter for any of them. This time next year, they'll have a new crop of horses. Mm. This is all about short-term. What can we win? What's the filly's going to be worth? $2 million anyway. It's going to go to stud, so... I don't think they care about what it's going to be this time next year. They just care about getting through these two-year-old races.
You're probably right there. I mean, it is fascinating and it's great and it's glamorous, exciting. But in the same breath, I mean, we're in here during the carnival and this is what we're complaining about, isn't it? You know, we don't produce any horses that go on beyond the age of 3 or 4. We have too many sprinters. So I guess we can't have it both ways.
If you're thinking of Godolphin and Coolmore globally, they're only thinking the season, aren't they? They're not thinking beyond the season of racing.
Not necessarily. I mean, certainly with their older horses, yes. I mean, the two-year-olds, they are thinking beyond just this season. Certainly, I think Aidan O'Brien would see most of what he achieves with Coolmore two-year-olds as a bonus on the way to what they're going to do as three-year-olds. And I suspect Charlie Appleby, Saeed Bin Saror, these guys feel the same way about their two-year-olds, you know.
Yeah. But the fact that it doesn't matter, it tells you about how deep the ranks are with Godolphin, because if one falls over, another one stands up. So, and then you got the two in Melbourne, and I just think it's fascinating because I think James Cummings as a trainer, it's a great story of... Because, mate, I'll eat humble pie. This time last year, I thought the whole thing was falling apart. I thought, for a number of reasons, I just thought they have to change the model. This just isn't working. But I reckon there's a few things that have been happening internally too. I think James has been great, but it's not all James. I think there's a philosophy about how they go about placement, who they use, Dominic Byrne, branching out beyond their own breeding ranks as well.
Vin Cox has changed things. I mean, he replaced Henry Plumptree, a different kind of person, a different background. Vin had a very commercial background, didn't he, with Magic Millions?
Well, it was interesting when I had a chat to Vin this morning. He said when he was at the Magic Millions, he was part of a group that went over to speak to His Highness and said, I think you need to change your model, or maybe things, this is what you should be doing, and it's buying horses again from the yearling sales, not just relying on your breeding stock and opening up their mind to that.
Well, they shut themselves off from so much opportunity. And so did Coolmore, because it all goes back to the war between Coolmore and Godolphin.
Yeah, that's changed, though. There's been a rapprochement, shall we say, in Europe. The Cold War is, has melted.
You and I were just saying at the back, Falgate, there's been a rapprochement.
I thought you had something stuck in your throat.
They have started buying stock by Galileo. They've started to buy Coolmore, you know, bred yearlings, and Coolmore have bought a couple of Dubawis. So they're obviously, you know, the hatchet has been buried, thankfully not quite in each other, and it'll benefit both, particularly Godolphin, I think, who certainly in that European arena, but here too, getting some of these speedy progeny, the Schnitzels and such like, surely it'll help them.
Well, I was up there at Agnes Banks 2 years ago. And
so was I.
You were obviously in Barn B when I was in Barn C. And it was all the Lonros and the Medagliadoros and the Street Criers and that. And I was talking to one of the guys up there and I said, what if these sires are all going terribly? You're stuck to them, you know? And then and the conversation went along those ways. It was just as they were starting to expand their thinking about it, because they couldn't get a Schnitzel. They couldn't get a...
Yeah, Redoutes or whatever.
Because they weren't, so they cut themselves off from all these amazing opportunities.
What about the day as a whole? I mean, the 3-year-old Magic Millions is run by Boom Sara. There's no stars out of that race. They're restricted races. They're, you know, only horses sold at the sale can run on them. The day as a whole, from a racing quality spectacle, it's not really about that, other than the 2-year-old race for the excitement. It's more about the promotion and sale of the sale itself. But racing in general, no one does it better over that week than what Magic Millions and Jerry Harvey's been able to do, the build-up and the promotion. And the money at the sale is just phenomenal. Lloydie Kennewell, well done to Lloydie. He's got the sale topper, a 1.7 I Am Invincible colt on the Saturday night out of Oakley Girl. He's closely related, obviously, to Schnitzel. 11 million plus yearlings. There was a 1.6 and a 1.4 as well. The average over 707 lots, 239,000. Book one grossing $170 million.
And the buying bench expanded more globally this year too, I think. So it's not about the quality. They get away with it, don't they? Because they have this lavish Channel 7 coverage and they got Francesca and all the big cup crew and all that. And you think, well, this normally represents elite racing, but it doesn't at the Gold Coast, but it doesn't matter, because you'll hear Richo and Francesca talk about, they've been behind the gates for a $1 million race full of horses that really aren't entitled in normal circumstances to have a crack at a million. And it's more about the dream and the celebration of the winners. And
yeah, and that's a really important part, though, of, you know, I'm hesitant to use the word narrative, but the storyline.
Well, say fremagerie.
I don't know what the French word for histoire, perhaps, story, for Australian, for Australian racing is, you know, that you can buy a cheap horse, or you can buy a relatively cheap one and race for extraordinary money. I mean, what was that thing that Tumultuous, you know, which is trained by Chris Waller, that's now won that Magic Millions trophy twice, hasn't it? I mean, that's I think $1 million race twice. A horse like Tumultuous.
And Bjorn Baker winner had been there four times. That was the fourth appearance.
I mean, you're right about the quality. I've just quickly flicked through the fields. I think Dothraki, our old mate Dothraki, rated 109, was the highest rated horse there out of about, what, you know, about 150 going round. So it's not exactly top quality, but on this day it doesn't really matter.
But it's amazing. The whole story is amazing, because they created something out of nothing, because they had these big powerful guys who all got together and decided to do it 30 years ago. But it's not it's shamelessly shallow. It's about glitz and glamour and all that sort of stuff, isn't it? It's shamelessly, but in a good way.
It's a very 80s greed is good concept.
It is.
You know, they should actually have a fancy dress party with everyone wearing shoulder pads, shouldn't they, and big hair?
Exactly.
Just to pay tribute to the era which spawned the concept.
Yachting shoes and the polo sort of fits with that theme as well. Yeah. So I reckon it's an amazing
success. Well, it is. They always say it's what, a sunny place for shady people.
Well,
and like that goat track of a track too. Like you wouldn't run there on a normal Saturday. You know?
Hello to all our Gold Coast listeners and those who love racing.
Well, it's a unique track for a big race.
Until you're up there again, Matty. Hey, got an SMS coming through, and this is a good question too, because the listener is asking, where do we think Yes, Yes, Yes would have fit into the race on Saturday? Because nothing went right for Weary's horse. He had to float up there, then he wasn't right. Was sore, they'd drawn the outside barrier. I think they made the right call pulling the pin instead of having a crack. But because he's looked very good. And that's that Brooklyn Hustle form.
Yeah.
So I was going to say, Jason Warren would love to have seen how he would have gone. Mm. Yes, yes, yes.
Yes, yes, yes. Well, he wouldn't have been a no, 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 but can we say he would have been a definite maybe?
Yeah, well, he likes
I'm trying to get hold of Jason Warren, actually, to put a story on the net, on our website, just to get his impression, because his greatest fear is probably the Godolphin Army now. Whatever they throw at him, he's probably going to be worried about because theirs are so powerful.
Well, the one that they anointed this morning is Aetheri, who's a Lonro filly, had one start for a win. That's their Blue Diamond number one seed. We're going to take a break. You're listening to The Verdict. Keep the SMSs coming through, and also tweet us at RSN927. I'm going to have a quick look at Flemington. Matty Stewart's got some breaking news on the RSN website, and also an update. Two really nasty falls, one in WA and one in New Zealand over the weekend. And we're also going to have a chat to Paul Bloodworth. The All-Star Mile nominations shut tomorrow. Still no nomination from Winx. It's looking more and more likely that she will not nominate. We'll find out who the top guns are. Also want to speak to Bloodworth about the number one issue in racing over the past few weeks here in Victoria, and that has been the debate about the firmness of tracks as well. All that's still to come on The Verdict.
RSN 927's Racing Pulse presents The Verdict.
Welcome back to The Verdict. A quick look at Flemington before we discuss some of the issues in racing. And it was a typical summer's meeting, slowly getting better. We had the list of Chester Manifold. And for mine, that was a highlight of the day because I thought it was great to see Tony Noonan. He was up on the Gold Coast trying to buy the next generation of stars for the stable. But he'd been doing it tough in recent years, and it was good to see him get a feature winner at Flemington with Manolo Blahnik, who was dominant in the end. And when you think of some of the trainers that are struggling to have regular city runners, let alone city winners, it just reiterates how tough the game is.
They're big names, aren't they, these trainers who are struggling? And he's made no secret of how difficult it's been for him in recent years, Tony Noonan, you know. Remember he had the big connection with Jonathan Munns.
Yeah, and he had Hortensia, didn't he, winning in England. Yeah. And was he training that when she won
Shono
in Dubai?
Emotion was the big sprinter.
Yeah, he was.
He got marched into the 52nd floor of the Rialto to get his marching orders from Jonathan Munns about 15 years ago.
Did he really?
Yep. Oh. And that was the end of that. And, he's a really good guy. He's a very intelligent bloke, a former school teacher, and he's an actor in Hollywood. The other one's Jake. He's been very proud to bring up his kids very educated and not fall into the trap of becoming horse trainers. So,
he's a lot like a lot of these trainers. If he has the right material, he can definitely do the job, can't he? But it is a problem that we're increasingly seeing, if you like, with the industrialisation of the mega stables, you know, with Hayes and Weir particularly in this area. And that's no knock on either of those two guys. They can build their businesses as much as they like and can, and it's a free country and free enterprise, but there are consequences for others and for the sport as a whole. And I guess it's the same in New South Wales, isn't it, with Waller and Waterhouse and Godolphin and the dominators up there.
Speaking of the industrial stable, like, didn't have anything on Chauffeur, Spewing, Weir. Takedown was the perfect project horse. He had a nice little run in Adelaide, and he got it to $18 on Saturday, and I was right all over him, and he just was gonna win, you know, that big elephant of a horse that he is, and then that Milano Blahnik had that last crack at him.
It was all right. Flemington had a couple of decent races on Saturday. I just wonder sometimes our off season, is it a bit sort of very long, this off-season break? I mean, it sort of starts to shut down quite significantly in the metropolitan area from Sandown Guineas Day. That's 2 months ago. That's mid-November.
But there's only so many really good horses, Lynchy, that you can keep running in these really good races. We've got the Autumn Carnival coming up.
I suppose we have a late summer Autumn Carnival.
And then it rolls into
I reckon spring and autumn bump into each other really quickly.
Yeah, it's well. Just look at the off season, like Sydney during the summer, they have the Villiers,
yeah, but
and
we've
they
got the Standish and the New Year's Day meeting, and that. But we've got the picnics, mate.
The picnics, indeed. Which I know you're an habitué of.
We'll get onto that in a moment because Matty's
an habitué Matty's of the picnics.
Got a big drum to beat about the picnics. Just out of Flemington, it was a good day for favourite backers, but outside of. Is the two-year-old microphone the one that really you want to take out of the meeting?
What about the stablemate too, the one that ran third? I think they're both as good as each other. And I think James said that too. It's great to get the trainers access to them. Saturday morning, the market said it was microphone, clearly the one, and the one that eventually ran third, both debutantes, was, you know, the market said there was a million miles between them, but James said, no, there's not at all. And the margin in the end, I think most people coming out of the race would think that the third place get is as good as the winner.
Well, yeah, I mean, interesting to hear Dwayne Dunn as well say that he thinks the third horse shapes more like a sort of 1400, 1600 horse, whereas this earlier one, the microphone, they're both by Exceed and Excel, does seem to be a bit sharper now and much more like a classic two-year-old, early prep two-year-old, doesn't it?
And I know we're not a breeding show, but the most unheralded superstar stallion of the training ranks, for what it's represented for Dali / Godolphin, Exceed and Excel is the most amazing winner-getter. If you walk through the barn at Osborne Park or Warwick Farm for that stable, say in late September of any year, and they've got all the two-year-olds in work, I guarantee you the ones that have progressed the most, 80% of them will be by Exceed and Excel.
Yeah, and he's done it overseas as well, hasn't he? He's stood in Europe and got winners there too. So, fantastic money spinner. But as you say, we're not a breeding show.
Well done to Paul Prushka. Nice win, I Am Someone. Do you think it could measure up to an autumn sprint, or this is too off Broadway?
Well, look at what he did with Magic Console.
Well, yeah, exactly right. Exactly right.
I know it was only a benchmark 70, but he did win in the style of a pretty good horse, didn't he? The a progressive type, anyway.
I'll just give a cheerio to Stevie Baster, too. For the listeners of our program on Thursday, when Stevie was in, he actually declared that Got the Moves was a sneaky little chance, and the last paid $7 the place. I think the Quinella paid $60-odd as well with the favourite. Ollie to the fore. Strange Ollie not riding up at the Gold Coast for the big dollars, but he was to the fore with Dwayne Dunn, Dean Yendall as well, so the older brigade leading the way at Flemington, staving off the young apprentices. And well done to Linda Meach, too, riding the first two winners at Randwick on Saturday, becoming the first dual licence holder to win a race at Royal Randwick. And I've got a lot of time for that star fall. Could win a very nice sprint, that galloper.
Is Linda Meach, forgetting how big Jamie Carr is and how she's such, you know, she's the go-to jockey for big stables, and Michelle Payne won the Melbourne Cup, but I wonder, and you got Cathy O'Hara and all these great female jockeys, but, and I know people will respond and say, oh, why do you know, don't talk about them as being great female jockeys. They're just great jockeys, but I understand that. But just for the context, is Linda Meach the best female jockey we've ever had?
She's certainly in the conversation, isn't she? She's won at least one Group 1 race. And the fact that, you know, Peter Moody, when he was absolutely killing it, wasn't he? I mean, Moody was as dominant in his day as Weir is now, wasn't he? You know, and Moody would have absolutely no hesitation on putting Linda up on whatever, anything really. You know, she used to do a lot of country riding for him, but she'd ride winners in town for him, and a lot of the other trainers would take their cue from him. She certainly seems to have every skill required to be right in that conversation.
If it's judged, depends on what you judge it on. If it's judged on glamour or super duper big wins and fame, it's not her. But if you judge it on longevity and chalking up the scoreboard year in, year out.
Well, I mean, Michelle's the only one who's had a super duper duper big famous win. I mean, the others have won Group 1 races, including Linda. I don't know if Jamie Carr's won a Group 1, has
consistency she? Of what Linda Meach does year in, year out has always been up there around the top jockey in Australia for number of wins and Victoria. You'd have to put her right up there. A couple of quick ones before we take a break, because we've got Paul Bloodworth coming up, and there's a number of issues we want to talk to Paul about, and you've got a picnic issue you want to speak about as well. I spoke to Jerry Harvey during the week, of course, the boss of the Magic Millions, and and I was intrigued with his take on the arms race war between New South Wales and Victoria, these big races, the proliferation of them, high-stake races on feature race days, and also the other states who are getting left behind. This is what Jerry's response was when I asked whether he thinks the arms race is a negative or a positive.
It's good. The two big ones, Victoria and New South Wales, and I think that the people at the top of the game there are having I don't like it that much feeling, but I think it's good. I think they're wrong. And Queensland, South Australia and all the rest are being left behind. So at some stage, the governments and the racing officials in those states have got to seriously look at, do they want to be relevant? I think they'll come to the party. I don't think they'll have any alternative. It's either that or die, and the racing officials will get the sack, the government will get the sack, and someone else will take over.
So that's someone who is one of the smartest business minds in Australia and probably looks outside the racing bubble, even though he runs the Magic Millions, about his thoughts on Sydney's encroachment into Victoria and these big race meetings and what the fallout effect will be for the other states. Oh, I was fascinated in his take on that. Matty, I know you vehemently disagree with him.
Well, I don't understand how he can have his both ways. He can't say the arms race is a great thing and New South Wales and Victoria can get bigger and bigger and stronger and better because of it. And then on the other hand, he says it's up to the other states to keep up. The other states, the fate of them is determined by what Victoria and New South Wales, the war. I mean, they're shutting everyone else out. So I don't see how Jerry can say, lift your game, smaller states, but the other thing is good. They can't both happen hand in hand.
Obviously, he's a hugely successful businessman in both commercial and the racing industry, but let's be honest, you'd hardly expect him to say anything else, would you? He's running an auction which has got wealthy owners predominantly from Victoria and New South Wales, so his auction will benefit because they'll just spend more and more and more buying horses to chase the dream of not just the riches on Magic Millions Day, but the riches increasingly escalating as a result of this prize money in their states. So obviously he's going to back it for that reason. And I think Matt's right. Irrespective of what you think about New South Wales, Victoria, they don't operate in isolation. It is a country. There is a kind of ecosystem of racing. And a lot of those states historically have benefited. The two main states have benefited. South Australia historically has been a very good feeder for Victoria, trainers, jockeys. New South Wales has benefited from top Queenslanders, particularly riders, I think, coming down there. And if you disturb that balance too greatly, you're going to upset the apple cart, I think. And, you know, I spent a bit of time in Adelaide over Christmas. I went and had long conversation with Grant Mayer, who runs the SAJC based at his Morphettville office. And, you know, they are doing it hard. Look at the size of the fields. You know, I mean, they obviously want to promote the locals, but he's essentially saying, well, we might have to rely on Victorian trainers to come across here and buttress our fields because the smaller fields. It's that vicious cycle, isn't it? Small fields, lower turnover, less interest, less promotion. And so he's looking to the locals to try and kick up, but for Victorians to come. And they're looking at a range of other, if you like, gimmicky kind of events, you know, that they might put on to be able to try and create and generate more interest in racing in that state. But I think it just needs to be seen as a national whole rather than just two states.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, what he said in that interview was just a spontaneous showmanship line. It wasn't thought out at all because, well, I ask you the question, how can the smaller states prosper if the bigger states won't allow them to?
I think what he is saying is that the governments need to ensure that the local states prosper regardless of what happens.
How are they magically going to do that?
By allocating more funding.
Certainly the point of consumption tax is an issue. I mean, Queensland solved that. They get a bigger kick out of it after threatening to disruptive action. Perhaps South Australia, it's the highest POC and there's no kickback to the industry. Maybe they're going to have to, you know, wax militant a bit like Queensland did before they might get some.
Is there any thought that they're closer to doing that?
No, I don't think they see that as an option except of absolutely last resort. I believe that Murray Bridge track is due to reopen sometime in May. So, you know, that might generate some interest. But
I've heard that there are a lot of issues with the how it's been set up.
Yeah, well, we'll see, I guess, when it starts going. But you know, Victoria and South Australia do have a long history and relationship. I don't know if the industry here can do anything from a financial point of view to help it, but certainly it would help if we'll probably may see more Victorian trainers running on Saturdays in Adelaide because the competition is lesser for them.
Well, then that's so just very quickly. That's what I was saying is the only way the smaller states can prosper is if the bigger states let them, and the arms race isn't going to help that.
It'll be interesting to see that continued debate, and still keen to have a chat to bosses when it comes to racing, the racing minister, but we can't seem to get hold of him. We'll keep trying, though, to get the latest on the landscape in South Australia. Matty, you've written an interesting story on the RSN website about a horse that a lot of people have forgotten about but is about to make a return to the track.
I didn't even think he was still alive, to be honest, Amrullah. So he was the Yucatan before Yucatan came along. And so for Lloyd, he won the 2015 Herbert Power in such a dominant way that he became the red-hot favourite for the Melbourne Cup. But what happened was he had previously been treated with just some cortisone in order to, just for maintenance, a little bit of arthritis and so on, but the cortisone wouldn't disappear from his system. So it ended up that Lloyd had to scratch the horse from the Melbourne Cup. He then sued the vet clinic because for malpractice, and it became this huge drama that led to the scratching of the Melbourne Cup favourite, and it played out of court with some sort of settlement, I believe, but that's not the main part of the story. So anyway, Robert Hickmott was his trainer, and this was the best imported horse he'd ever had. Mm-hmm. Suddenly he bobs up on an online Lloyd Williams auction. You know, that's the way they do it. You just click. It's like, you know, those ones with Gumtree.
Yeah, or eBay or something.
He and his brother, Michael, who loved the horse, are clicking away on this online auction, and they got him for 19 grand. This is the horse that, in Prince of Penzance this year, was the hot favourite for the Melbourne Cup. Still an entire, got him for 19 grand. They've resurrected him, they've treadmilled him, they've sort of nursed him, and he's had two jump outs, and he's winning them like bloody Gennady, dare I say. The Robbie
Gennady. I don't know if you want to make that comparison.
No, I don't want to bring that up. So he's flying. He won a jump out at Sandown the other day over 800 metres, beating all these fast horses. And Robert Hickmott, it's a dreamy sort of scenario, but he wants to have a crack at the Australian Cup. He thinks that the All-Star Mile will sap the Australian Cup a bit. And he's going to run him on the 9th, I think, or the 19th of February at Flemington, and then have a crack at the Australian Cup with this ghost from the past.
It'll be a fairy tale story. You can read that on the RSN website. And Matty, you've also written an update on a more sobering story, which is two really bad falls on Saturday. One in New Zealand, one in WA. Have you got an update on the condition of the two jockeys?
Really sort of 5,000 kilometres apart and minutes apart in real time. So in the... Over in Western Australia, Natasha Faithful had ridden a double at Albany, and then she's riding track work through the sand dunes at Albany the next day, and the horse tumbled down the sand dune on top of her. Oh, and she was airlifted to the hospital where she has multiple fractures, a collapsed lungs, lacerated liver, and really, it was really touch and go. She's still in a critical condition, but as that was occurring at a similar time at a place called Kumara in New Zealand, this Mauritius-born apprentice, Zabir Bola, fell really heavily and was airlifted to Christchurch Hospital. He lay motionless on the track for 7 or 8 minutes. His trainer thought he was dead. Mm. Three fractures in the neck, a broken collarbone, shoulder, and severe laceration to the jaw and chin. And thankfully, especially as we all are still mindful of the situation with Ty Anglin, he didn't have any spinal cord damage. So I just think it's amazing how, you know, death and injury with jockeys. We know them, we socialise with them, they're all mates, and we see them, we bag them, and we, you know, all that sort of stuff, and we back them. But every day, there's no such profession where such risk is involved, even track work, not even race riding, you know?
Well, I know, you're better off being a boxer. You know, the fatality rate in boxing would be far less than in race riding.
Well, we wish them all the best. We'll continue to follow their recovery, and let's hope that they do make a very speedy recovery. And once again, anyone who wants to donate, the National Jockeys Trust, and you've got the Big Jockey Cricket Day, which is being held on the 21st of January down at the Williamstown Oval. A lot of stars are going to be there. Michelle, Stevie Payne, Brett Pebble, Damien Oliver, Stevie Arnold, Danny O'Brien, Manny Galagotis, Matty Kamani. We're also going to have the likes of Fev and Archie Thompson down there. So make sure you donate to the National Jockeys Trust. We're going to take a quick break. On the other side of this, Paul Bloodworth from the VRC is going to give us an update on from the Racing Victoria. What did I say? From Racing Victoria, we're going to get an update on the All-Star Mile. Maddie wants to bring up an interesting quirk that is starting to come into play in the picnics, and we'll also get a bit of an update as to the investigation and the review on the firmness of tracks here in Victoria.
RSN 927's Racing Pulse presents The Verdict.
Welcome back to The Verdict. SMSs are coming back saying Michelle Payne is the best ever. Another one saying, Maddie, I agree with you. I've also got a lot of time with for Raquel Clark. Another person saying about the prize money up on the Gold Coast. I was a part owner in Mahuta, who won almost $2 million. Great to it. And then someone else saying there was a $1.6 million four-star maiden going around at sale yesterday. So it's not all chocolates for those who spend the big dollars. Great to have a chat to Paul Bloodworth, who rejoins us after having a couple of well-earned weeks off. And what a good time to come back, because tomorrow at midday, it's the official cut-off time for the All-Star Mile nominations. How are you, Paul?
I'm good, thanks, Michael. How are you?
Yeah, very well. Where are we sitting with the nominations? How many have we got at the moment, and do you think there'll be a flurry of late entries?
Well, I really hope so. We're sitting at around 103, 104 at the moment. We had a couple come in over the weekend. We had, of course, Godolphin. Very exciting news on Saturday at the Magic Millions, announced their three nominations, Elise, Hartnell and Best of Days. So, look, as to whether we have a flurry, I mean, Chris Waller is still one that we're waiting for to nominate horses. And, of course, there's one fairly major nomination that we're hoping for at this point, but that hasn't been nominated in Winx.
Realistically, is it going to be nominated or not?
Look, I guess we're hopeful more than anything now, Michael. I mean, a nomination doesn't necessarily mean anything other than you get eligible to be in the voting. It's not necessarily an intention to run. So I guess we would hope that Chris and the team would nominate. But I guess if they've made the decision and she's not running, well, maybe they won't do it. But we've still got our wild cards up our sleeve that we announced shortly after the voting closes. So I guess we'll spend the next 4 to 6 weeks trying to twist Chris and the owner's arm to get her to run in the race. So, yeah, I guess we'll just have to wait and see what happens. It's about 25 hours to go, so they haven't got much time left to make up their mind.
Surely, Paul, it would be actually better for you if she didn't nom. You can give her a wild card if you want, and this way at least she won't just mess up the voting and just be a kind of disruptor.
Well, the beauty of this, Lynchy, is that noms are closing in 25 hours, and to some extent I think the fun begins from there. None of us really know how that's going to play out, and even I guess you're insinuating that if Winx were to nominate, she almost certainly would be the most popular horse in the race and voted number one, and that may well be true, but we've got mechanisms in place for horses that end up in the top 10 and don't end up taking their place in the field. So I don't really see an issue there. I guess, look, from our end, we want Winx there. She's the best horse in the world. She'd be a great horse to kick off the inaugural All-Star Mile. So we'll be doing everything we can to get the owners and Chris to run the horse there. If she doesn't nominate, you know, the nominations are very, very strong at the moment. 27 Group 1 winners already nominated in the 100-odd nominations. So it's going to be an amazing and fantastic race no matter what happens, whether Winx is there or not.
And the public poll opens on January 21, which, as you said, once that opens up, that's when we'll have a lot of fun and interaction with I suppose live updates as to who the voting is favouring. Winx 2, by the way, returns tomorrow in a barrier trial at 8:15, and we'll cover that live here on RSN 927. Hey, Paul, while you're away, a huge talking point here from trainers in Victoria has been the firmness of the tracks and what the policy is from Racing Victoria, and I understand there's a review into that policy. Where does that stand at this point in time?
I've certainly noticed that, Michael. My Twitter feed is full up with conversations about tracks, and there's one thing for certain when it comes to the preparation of tracks, and that is that everybody's got an opinion on it. I don't envy the task of our track managers, who I think just broadly and generally do a fantastic job across the board in Victoria. Yeah, it's pretty clear we're undergoing a review at the moment. We've actually conducted three reviews in the last 5 or 6 years into track preparation. The first review actually led to a change, and that was in 2014. And we reviewed it again in 2016, and nothing was changed. So I guess the current track preparation policy has been in place for 4 or 5 years, so it was due for a review again. We're taking the views of owners, trainers, jockeys, clubs, track managers, punters, stewards and vets. And, of course, almost the number one consideration is that we're looking at is the welfare of the horse.
Why do they have a voice, Blood?
Sorry, what's that?
Why do punters have a voice?
Oh, well, because they're our number one consumers of the sport, Matty. I mean, of course, we have to. I'm not saying that any one of those necessarily have a majority vote, if you like.
Right.
But we're getting the views of all those that consume Victorian racing, and any change to a policy like this would have an impact on. So I think that's only fair. And in relation to something like this, there's got to be balance. There's got to be balance between the needs of our trainers and the welfare of the horse. And also the needs of our consumers that are the punters. So because of the product that they like betting on, which is Victorian racing. So I'm not saying that one's necessarily got more sway than the other, but we are just getting the views of all those that consume Victorian racing.
I guess all I'm saying is if it's overwhelmingly the view of the majority of trainers that firm tracks is a horse welfare issue, then the view of punters is irrelevant.
Oh, I wouldn't necessarily say that because, I mean, I guess there's degrees of how far you would go necessarily in that, and I think that seems to be one of the misconceptions here as to what trainers are asking for. I don't think they're asking for a radical change in how tracks are prepared. I think they're asking for, I guess, to put it bluntly, a little bit more water to be put on tracks during the warmer months of the year to produce slightly softer ground, not considerably softer ground. There's a whole range of implications around that, for the clubs and their track managers, and I guess what extenuating circumstances come out of that by overwatering or putting more water on during months of the year, and then what happens when you get to winter when it does rain. But of course, you know, we have to take into account that the people that bet on Victorian racing have a clear preference for tracks that are firm, if you like, good to firm. And that, of course, you know, they're the lifeblood of our industry, punters. Without people betting on Victorian racing, we'd all be doing something else.
Paul, Mick Kent, we're almost out of time, but Mick Kent wrote an article on RSN's website saying that he's not that concerned with the firmness of tracks, but the accuracy of the ratings. And you said it's subjective, but you speak to a number of different people who walk the track, and they may have different views on how firm the track is and where the best going is. But he believes that they're not getting the accurate ratings on race day, the stewards. And I know we got rid of our independent, or we got rid of the track walkers. Is there a thought process of having a respected independent walker to give an independent analysis? Or what are your thoughts on that?
Well, look, I'm not an expert on the rating of tracks, Mick. I would say that we do have independent, respected people rating the tracks at the moment, and that's the track managers who do it at first thing in the morning. It's the steward's role to monitor the condition of the track when they arrive at the races during the day. I'm just not sure around this view that tracks are being rated incorrectly. I mean, our track managers are using very modern technology in rating these tracks.
I think it's more to do with during the day, the changing conditions, not so much the initial rating.
Yeah, I mean, look, I guess that's, I'm not the one making those decisions on the day. I know the stewards take into account times and feedback from jockeys on the day. I guess we're not ruling anything out in relation to having independent people providing advice on that. But we've got, very experienced stewards and the current system seems to have served us reasonably well. That's not to say it's perfect. So I guess that's a matter for the stewards to work out on the day.
And just final question, when do we think we'll have the finality of this current review that's ongoing?
Look, I don't think there's any finite timeline. Michael, of course, you know, we've got to get it done in the next few months. I know there's still ongoing consultation with some of the people that I mentioned earlier. So that will, I guess, run its course. And then probably, I would imagine, the next 2 or 3 months we would have an outcome on that.
Blood, thanks for your time this morning. I know Matty Stewart's going to be in the chair the next couple of weeks, and no doubt he'll be having a chat to you as well about a number of issues, including one at the picnics, which, Matty, I'm sure you're going to discuss more tomorrow with your guest in the studio. But, Blood, we'll catch up soon.
Thanks, guys, and have a good break, Michael.
Thanks, mate. Paul Bloodworth from Racing Victoria. And, we are out of time, but, Matty, I know you've got Charlotte Littlefield in tomorrow, and it'll be great to speak to her about this because you've been going to the picnics quite a lot recently, and there's a murmuring of discontent amongst some of the trainers saying that it's difficult for the old-fashioned picnic trainer, picnic horse, to win those races because a lot of the city or country professional, if you like, horses are filtering in there.
Yeah, more so than they used to be, and the handicapping, my understanding, talking to a lot of trainers yesterday, is that the picnic horses that are winning at the picnics are being over bad at the wrong end of the handicapping, and horses that are winning, say, 0 to 58s at the professionals, much better horses and better form, are actually getting in too well at the weights at the picnics.
Isn't this just a consequence of what we were talking about earlier? As the big get bigger and dominate, metro
they reach
and
out
increasingly
further.
Country, yep. The smaller yep. guys are push to go deeper and lower themselves.
Yep. Just one thing that I'll follow up as well, something that Paul just mentioned as well, that punters prefer firm tracks. I want evidence of that too. I mean, I know that there's 2 or 3 noisy punters who have a very firm view, and you know that, but I'm not sure overwhelmingly that punters who see horses pull up lame on and underperform on firm tracks.
I think it's more to do with turnover. I think the turnover figures say that the firmer tracks attract more turnover than wet tracks, softer tracks.
Well, I think that requires a lot of investigation as well. Anyway, it's a difficult debate. There's no doubt.
It is an outdoor sport, as I've said so many times on this, and we do have to take weather. If you've got a horse that's a mudlark, you want really soft tracks. That's his time of the year, isn't
we
it?
We never get wet tracks in winter anymore.
Well, they move them to the synthetics if they're wet. Exactly. Anyway, you know. But if you've got a horse that wants a brick road, that's a real fast ground specialist, doesn't he get the chance to have his time in the sun?
There aren't
in
many
January?
Of them.
No, maybe
well, the
not.
Track's drained so well. So it's an ongoing debate, which we have each and every summer, and there will be a lot more to come out of the review. I'm off for a couple of weeks. Matty Stewart will be in the chair. He's already left the studio, Matty Stewart. He is. he will be in the chair the next couple of weeks. Mickey Lynch, I'll see you when I get back.
Indeed.
Tomorrow, Charlotte Littlefield and Julian Hay will join Matty Stewart in the studio for Racing's Open Mic. In the meantime, I hope you're back. Plenty of winners. I'll see you in a couple of weeks.